This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. As part of our 30 Issues in 30 Days coverage, we're diving into a topic that many people don't even really associate with the government. But as it turns out, the government's role is enormous. Medical and scientific research, which has led to new vaccines, new cures, energy breakthroughs, even the internet. But how much should the government be involved in this area? How important is government money compared to, say, money from companies like Merck and Pfizer? It may not be an issue that the presidential candidates are talking about much this time around, but we will get into it now with two people who understand how research migrates out of the lab and into our lives. Art Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. Art Kaplan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Steve Goldstein, the provost and a professor of biochemistry at Brandeis University. Steve Goldstein, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to join you.
So, Art Kaplan, let me start with you. You know, I mentioned in the intro here that government plays a very large role, especially in the medical area, in bringing cures, vaccines into people's lives. How crucial is the role that the government plays in your view?
It's crucial, vital. I think people don't understand sometimes because they see big companies ranging from Microsoft and Google to the Mercks and the Pfizers and the Glaxos, and they think, well, why do we have to put any of our tax money, government money, into these activities? The answer is, companies, private companies, are not going to spend money on basic research, on fundamental foundational research, because it takes too long to pay off, and it often doesn't pay off. It's kind of a gamble as to whether you're going to get a drug or a practical application or a new software program when you're just starting out in the lab or at the bench or even at a desk. Government has to pay for that as a kind of public good or common good. If we're going to get the results of doing the most foundational basic research, you can't go to the marketplace. They're waiting for products that they can sell easily and that are very close to, if you will, being ready to go to market. That's where government has a key role to play.
Now, when you talk about that foundational, fundamental research that may not lead to the actual pill in the bottle, it may not lead to the actual microchip, that kind of thing, what are you talking about? Like, explain to people, what is basic research? What does that mean?
So basic research may be inquiry into animal research, trying to understand what's going on with animals that are simpler systems. Let's say you might say, well, what do I care if the government puts out a grant to understand the genetic makeup of a worm? I mean, really? Given all the other priorities we have? But the reason government does that, and the reason it becomes very, very important, is the worm has a lot fewer genes and a lot fewer genetic interactions than our genes. And if you want to understand, say, why it is that a particular disease state starts or how genetics are regulating the development of normal organs as opposed to genetic diseases, you look for simpler systems. Now, there's no company that's going to sit around and say, yeah, you're right. Let's pay for the worm. let's start there. Similarly, if you're going to look at a basic mechanism, let's say in human biology, you want to understand something like, well, how does a particular molecule work to trigger a response to a cancer? You may be hoping down the road you could turn that molecule into a drug or maybe a vaccine trigger. But at the very, very beginning, you got to start off saying, gee, I wonder what this molecule does in a cell or in a dish, and then build up from there. So that's the sort of thing we're talking about with basic research.
And Steve Goldstein, as Art Kaplan says, a lot of times these ideas, things that have promise, they don't go anywhere. They fail.
Well, that's true, although the best science always leads you to the next idea. If you're asking the right question, you end up someplace that moves you towards understanding. One of the scientists at Brandeis is Professor Michael Rosbach, and he was interested, he was stimulated by a report about how the leaves on a plant open and close in response to the time of day. He began to study that and move the thinking he was doing on plants to fruit flies, another thing very far from human health. What he discovered were the basis for circadian rhythms, the rhythms that determine our sleep-wake cycles, that determine our response to medications and how our body responds to the world. That started at a place way too uninteresting for a drug company.
But interesting enough for, let's say, the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about companies. And Steve Goldstein, I'm going to press you on something mm-hmm. that Art Kaplan said. So if you look back at 2010 and you look at all that sort of big pot of money that's being given out for medical research, for pharmaceutical research, the pharma companies themselves, so the Mercks, the Pfizers, the Novartis, you know, all that, they invested about $67 billion in research, a lot of money. That's more than half of the money that's invested in research. Government was about a third. So what's the difference between government and pharmaceutical research if the pharma companies are already investing most of the money? Why don't we don't they want to, you know, cure cancer and come up with the next blockbuster drug? Why don't we leave it to them?
It's a great question, and I think Art touched on it just the right way. Yes, they would love to cure cancer, unless they're not going to make a profit doing it. So they're interested in invest in R&D, and they're interested in the D, in the developments, which is things that are close to bringing to market. And if that assessment about bringing them to market does not generate profit, they're not interested again. So you have both the very basic studies that need to be done in an academic environment, which take a long time to come to fruition. And you also have to do those studies where the payoff to society may be great, but the payoff to a company may not be so great. And that's one of the issues that stymies vaccine development.
So if it may take 20 years to work on an Alzheimer's cure, it just may not be worth it because by then you could be bankrupt or the amount that you'll make on the cure is not good enough to compensate for what you've done so far.
You need to be close to market for most industry to pay any good attention. And in fact, in the last decade, some of the biggest companies have pulled back on their research programs and are looking to depend on universities to provide the basic findings. And that's been a real problem because academia doesn't have the resources to actually step in and fill the gap.
Now, Art Kaplan, I don't know what you've been hearing on the campaign trail, but I don't hear a lot of talk about the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation from either of the candidates. Do you feel like this is something that should be talked about on the campaign trail?
Absolutely. And you're right. They haven't said much about it. The last campaign, Obama-McCain, we heard about it a little bit because listeners may remember we're having a big fight about embryonic stem cell research and funding that. And it became an issue or a sort of a lightning rod between conservatives and others as to whether the government should be in that line of research funding. It shows how important basic research funding is because if no one's funding embryonic stem cell research with government grants, the chances are pretty good. Again, as Steve said, private industry isn't going to do it. The distance from trying to manipulate embryonic stem cells to a product was very far. This round, we don't hear much going on at all. It's partly because I think the, you know, economy has jumped to the fore and other things are kind of dominating the election differences. But we ought to hold these candidates accountable. I have looked on their websites. Mitt Romney says he wants to do more private sector funding to move American research along. Obama says he wants to make sure that government has a healthier role to play. No one is sitting there saying, though, you know, we spend $30 billion roughly for the NIH, should we increase that even in hard times? Isn't that going to generate more jobs? Isn't that going to generate more health? So we ought to hold them accountable for their positions in this area.
This is Steve. I absolutely agree. And when we look at what the research dollars do, they don't just bring us new discoveries, but they also train the next generation of scientists and engineers, many of whom then become the underpinning of our economy. So NSF funding supported graduate students, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and that's so they could work on this innovative prototype of a search engine they called PageRank. Well, the PageRank method is now what we know as Google. And so if we don't train for the future, we also risk our preeminent status as leaders in the world and as competitors in the global economy.
That's a really interesting point, because Google now employs, it's well north of 40,000 people. So here, this one grant turned into something that really paid off in the end. And Art Kaplan, let me come back to you on that. I wonder, is being cheap in the long run, to coin a phrase, simply not going to pay off? For being cheap, rather, in the short run, is that not going to pay off in the long run? These kinds of investments that Steve Goldstein's talking about in individual people, either with tech companies or with energy ideas or with potential medical advances, that kind of thing.
It isn't going to pay off. And let me say, we've got an enormous $1 trillion-plus healthcare economy just alone that we're trying to reform. We're spending $30 billion on the research side of that. We are being penny-wise, pound-foolish. I'm sure my old sort of inspiration, Ben Franklin, were he to come back today, would say, you guys are crazy. The way you're going to work out of an economic slump is to do some investment in basic research, watch the spin-out discoveries move forward, let that drive your economy. Let me add, too, we've spent some money in the past, say, mapping the human genome, starting to understand the basic biology and function of the human brain. Well, if we're not going to spend more to kind of deliver the research out of those exciting breakthrough discoveries about how our genes are made up or how our brain is interconnected, then we've wasted a lot of money, too. So I think it makes no sense. I think we get a lot of conversation, for example, about technologies from yesteryear and organizations that support them. The future, if we're not going to be beholden to other countries, if we're not going to tell the next generation we don't have cures or technological improvements for you, is to get government on that basic science funding side.
And Steve Goldstein from Brandeis, it's interesting because we do hear about health, not just health care, but, for example, Mitt Romney's wife, Anne, has struggled with multiple sclerosis. We hear President Obama talk about his mom who died from breast cancer. But how do you get candidates then to make the connection between the illnesses they're talking about and the funding that could change the game for those illnesses?
I think they're worried of being attacked for being unrealistic, because some of the best ideas look unrealistic. On the other hand, I think you can make very cogent cases. You can look at the discoveries that we've made and how it's changing our lives. If you imagine for a moment life without basic scientific research, if you start with imagine you're sadly in a car accident and you end up in the hospital and they have no imaging devices. There's no MRI. There's no CAT scan. And then there's no antibiotics for the infection. And there's no microsurgery. And there are no monitors. You begin to imagine what life would be like without the findings. I'm not sure how easy that is to put in a political soundbite. I think that maybe you have to start talking about life without a cell phone, life without a computer. But even so, we're used to these things.
Let me jump in there just with one other comment. I'm a little bit troubled that the media doesn't push here. I think at these debates, it'll be interesting to see if anybody puts a science question on the table. I'm worried that we spend a lot of time going through some of the nuances of foreign policy. Was the Libyan embassy properly defended? Did we have the right security there? Those are issues I'm not sure the American people can do much about. They're kind of handled, if you will, by experts and bureaucrats. Whether or not there's going to be a cure for your dad's Parkinsonism, whether or not you're going to be in a position to eat healthier food. Those are things that, you know, touch our lives directly, and yet we don't get the kind of questions on that side of the ledger from the media pushing the candidates hard, I think. So I think it's partly a communication problem, too.
We're going to get into some of those questions. We're talking about science and medical research with a focus on how it's funded. And we're also asking the question, who should fund it? Should the National Institutes of Health have a bigger budget? Should Big Pharma be a little smaller? It's one of the many topics we're taking on as part of our 30 Issues in 30 Days election coverage. The conversation continues on Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're continuing our 30 Issues in 30 Days election coverage with a look at medical and scientific research, focusing on just how much the government should be involved in this area. And I'm joined by two people who know a lot about the topic. Art Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, and Steve Goldstein, the provost and a professor of biochemistry at Brandeis University. And Steve Goldstein, let me come to you here to sort of touch on something that Art was saying before. We've pretty much seen the NIH, National Institutes of Health budget stay pretty much static for about a decade. And if you factor in the fact that there's inflation and things just cost more than they did a decade ago, it's really less money allocated to the NIH. What do you see happening? What is the effect of that? I mean, you see it from an academic standpoint, which I assume is where a lot of National Institutes of Health money ends up.
That's absolutely right. And the pressure is intense and the feedback loop is negative. You make it harder for people to pursue novel ideas. They pursue safer ideas. You make it harder for those who are just starting their careers to get resources, and they're coming with the newest and brightest energy, and they are our future. And old guys like me have more experience at garnering the research dollars. It is very important. And as that shrinks, it's compounded by the fact that during that same decade, states have been removing their resources from the research pot. The endowments of the universities have been suffering. And the net result is that it becomes harder and harder to push this engine forward.
Art Kaplan, you know, you hear anecdotal evidence, but widespread that people who are just starting out in science, as Steve Goldstein says, are increasingly discouraged, may find careers in other fields because it's very hard to get funding for the kind of research they want to do. What are you seeing?
I see it every day. I see people coming in and saying, I want to pursue a career in clinical research, but I'm not sure there's going to be any money there for me when I get out. I see people saying, I'm not going to do stem cell work. Too tough to find funding. I can't build a career out of uncertain funding sources. I do see people turning away from careers. Also, I see a bunch of people jammed up as adjuncts or part-timers or stuck on postdocs, wandering around the world. Some of our best and brightest young people are not going up the ladder because the grant competition is tough. And let me put another spin in here just to sort of spice up the debate a little bit. I think some of the lack of funding and the indifference is that some discoveries are not welcome politically. Climate change comes to mind. Impact of pollution in causing asthma. Not every discovery is one that all people of different political outlooks are going to sit around and applaud and clap and say, thanks for letting us know that air pollution or secondhand smoke or whatever give us health problems. So not everybody is going to stand up and salute the findings of science. Again, I think you've got to hold people accountable and say, where are you on this? Are you willing to sort of go where the truth takes you? Are you willing to kind of underwrite work that might have immense social policy consequences. Got to push hard there.
And as you were saying, that was the issue with stem cell research and President George W. Bush trying to thread the needle on that and talk about babies that had come out of stem cell research.
Right.
Is your view that Congress then is dragging its feet on funding for, let's say, the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation?
It is. Absolutely it is. And I think part of the drag is what I said. It's not always popular to put up with findings that may be at odds with your ideological or political beliefs. And sometimes science finds out things that people don't want to hear. There's a certain lack of science in the legislatures. We don't have that many scientists in Congress at the federal level and not that many at the state level. That's a problem that people are science averse. You know, I'm sometimes laughing, thinking that the people in Congress probably had their last science course in high school and said, you know, thank goodness that's over. That may not be the crowd you want to go to say, well, how much do you really want to spend on science and biomedical research? So there's a problem there. And I think the other reason there's foot dragging really out there is the distance or the connection to what goes on in the basic science funding area to what you see at the pharmacy, to what you see at home in terms of the technology around you, to many of the benefits Steve was talking about. It's a long road, so it's hard to make the connection.
Yeah, Steve, is Congress allergic to science?
I think I'm scared that that's the case. And at the same time, what you can see is that the rest of the world has looked at how successful we were based on these investments. And they're emulating our success from the 20th century. And as a result, they're investing in research universities. They are attracting some of our best to go there, and they are going to become the powerhouse competitors that we would like to stay. It's a real problem. And the foundations that try and fill in the gap do not have the resources. They are important. They are special, but they are constantly trying to leverage the much larger resource possibility of the government investing.
So when people try to apply to the Gates Foundation for something or the Howard Hughes Medical Institute or something like that, that is not stepping in. They don't have as big a footprint as the government does.
They simply do not. Their goal is to make something interesting enough so that the government then puts its resources to bear. And a lot of the medical foundations that focus on individual diseases are trying to leverage the government to prove if they make initial steps, then it will seduce the government to put its money into the area.
Now, you talked about other countries maybe outpacing us in this area. What do you see? I mean, you see, undergraduates and graduate students and postdocs. Are people actually leaving to go to other countries and work in colleges and universities there?
I think that we're still in a position of great strength. We're still leading globally. But the competition is getting fierce. And as we underinvest, we are losing ground. The major developing countries and our competitors are still sending many of their best students here to study, but they're now able to bring them back to their own countries, and we used to be able to get them to stay.
And Steve, I want to ask you, what are the countries that you have really impressed you in terms of the commitment and investment they're willing to make in this area, science and medical research?
I think that the sleeping giants are China and India.
And Art Kaplan, what are you seeing in terms of people leaving and countries that are impressing you in terms of their ability to invest?
Well, I think Steve hit the nail on the head. We used to get the best and the brightest from around the world to come here, do their PhD, do their MD, PhD, do their engineering work, and many stayed. Now many go back, and that is a huge problem. We've also made it hard to stay here. That has to do with immigration policies and terrorism fears and all the rest of that. But even getting somebody through the door and then having them stay on, even if they're brilliant and doing great research and want to stay, can turn out to be quite a hurdle. So again, that's an area where Congress has been kind of asleep at the switch. It's one thing to sort of say, you know, we want to protect against bad guys coming here. It's another thing to say we want to protect against biochemists coming here. It's a different problem. all that said, you know, I keep thinking, well, what would I sum this up as, or what would I want to get the listener to this thinking? Put it pretty simply. We spend about $30 billion, as I said, on the NIH. How many people, or what would you say, is going to give us more return? $10 billion more on defense, $10 billion more on the NIH? That's the question that I think our presidential candidates ought to be asked, and some of our candidates for Senate in your state and Congress generally. I know where I can absolutely give the answer to that. $10 billion more in the NIH would generate jobs, cures, products, great things. $10 billion more in defense wouldn't get us more than a tiny, tiny percentile increase in security.
Now, what if somebody said, well, I think we can really generate private sector interest here. I really think we can cultivate private sector interest in supporting some of this research. Maybe we can get them to step up. Do you think that's possible? Do you see that potentially happening?
I don't. I think basically the private sector answers ultimately to its bankers and its investors, and they're not interested in supporting American infrastructure, building more labs, building things that physicists and engineers and biochemists can use, supplying the tools. Or not, that's not what they do. Their investors would get mad at them if they did that kind of stuff. You have to have a government role. It's just like highways. It's just like bridges. You got to build that infrastructure, too, and that's not going to be the private sector.
Steve Goldstein, what do you see in terms of the Mercks and the Pfizers? Are they putting increasing amounts of money into research? Are they putting less over time? Where are they moving?
Unfortunately, I think that, as Art said, they are responding to the pressures of the economy, and industry and business have largely dismantled the large corporate research labs of the 20th century, the Bell Labs. And big pharma and biotech are moving towards those things they can bring to market rapidly. The timeline for investment capital is a number of years. They need to see it happening quickly. And that happens when you do things like turn drugs into Me Too drugs, where it's very much the same, but not a dramatic change. It's not dealing with new diseases that we haven't yet conquered. And we have chronic diseases that represent 50% of the reason that we still die on this planet, heart disease, diabetes. We have infectious diseases that in the United States we're doing reasonably well with, and yet one in four deaths is still from infection. There is so much yet to do, and we have such evidence the investment works.
Earlier this year, Eric Nielsen, who is the dean of Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, wrote a very compelling piece about this issue and really lamented the lack of NIH funding. And he talked about some of the things, some of them older discoveries that have come from government money. He talked about the necessity of washing hands, ways to extract insulin, the creation of antibiotics, the treatment of tuberculosis, the treatment of gastric ulcers and leukemia. Steve Goldstein, and then I'll come to you, Art Kaplan. Is there a role for scientists here, for doctors, for people to get out on a more public stage instead of talking to each other and present some of these stories to the public?
I think that's absolutely very powerful, and one just needs to be careful that what those doctors and scientists are doing is selling something where they don't have a vested interest, and that becomes the careful part so that people don't raise an eyebrow. The example that I like to use of the impact, because I've trained as a pediatrician and very committed to child health, is that 2 million children die every year on the planet from pneumonia. 98% of those deaths are in the developing world because they don't have the vaccines and antibiotics we have. So if you wanted to influence world health, we already have the methods to save all those children. And it also shows the power of what our research has done for us.
And Art Kaplan, I will give you the last word on this.
Well, I think, again, we've got to hold our politicians' feet to the fire. This funding, government role in basic research, foundational research, and building scientific infrastructure, the labs and the equipment, making them available, That's going to return manyfold to our benefit, much more than most other investments do. We want to make sure that we know where our politicians stand on funding this. So I think on the list of issues that you're reviewing, this ought to be a top priority.
We've been looking at scientific and medical research with a focus on who funds it. And we're asking the question, who should fund it? I've been speaking with Art Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, and Steve Goldstein, the provost and a professor of biochemistry at Brandeis University. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in, joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3.
Well, Kara, guess what? We're actually going to jump off the campaign trail to talk about something that is forever important, fiction. Novelist Louise Erdrich is joining us to talk about her new book, The Roundhouse. I'm Callie Crossley.
And I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.